Good morning, Arkansas. Welcome, everybody. I've been asked to remind you, please, to turn off your phones. Always good to have a reminder. Nice to see some new faces, some people from England. Yeah, Charles over there. Where's that? Yeah. It used to be in Europe, but now it's hard to find. By way of advance notice, next week and running towards Pesach, it's been a while since we talked about kashrut issues. And I'd like to start a little mini-series starting next week dealing with kashrut. And I'd like to start off with the complicated but very relevant sugya of gelatin and gel cap medicines. There's lots to talk about there, and we haven't, as I say, talked about kashrut for a while, so if you like, that's what's coming up soon. But today we're in something completely different to kashrut. And let me remind you what we said in part one, and today in part two I think you'll see some sources that will take you a little bit by surprise. Most of what we're going to read today is actually in English, because it was written in English, and it's translated into Hebrew, seems like a bit of a waste of time. But we will have some other classic sources as well. So let's recap. Let me tell you what we did in part one. We mentioned last week that the classical dating system for the Second Temple period, which is set out in Seder Olam Rabba. Seder Olam Rabba is a work in the Gemara. It's referenced to, referred to in the Gemara. It's attributed to Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta. And definitely the Talmud Bavli is well aware of it, and it's used by Chazal. Seder Olam Rabba recounts the years from creation through the Tanakh and post-Tanakh as well, and it says as follows. There were four kings that spanned the Persian period. One, Mede, who was Dariavesh, the Mede, who was the one who attacked Belshazzar. This is all we're looking at last week's stuff. And then three Persian kings. There was Koresh, there was Ahasuerus, and then there was Dariavesh. Okay, Cyrus, Ahasuerus, who is Xerxes, and then Darius, who eventually gave permission to rebuild the Second Temple. Three, and only three Persian kings. They spanned a period of 52 years, and if you add up the dates together, it'll turn out that the Second Temple period was around, well, exactly, say Chazal, 420 years. And therefore, this year, if you add up all those dates, is 5779. However, we said that it was already known for 1,000 years that the classical secular dating system for the same period was very, very different. And in fact, rather than three kings, they refer to at least 11 kings. Not only are there Koresh, Ahasuerus, and Dariavesh, but there are other people as well, like Cambyses, and Artaxerxes, and the first, and the second, and the third, and the fourth, etc., etc., etc. On that basis, the Second Temple period lasted much longer, more like 589 years. And in fact, this year is not 5779, but it's 5947. Okay. And last week we raised the question, what are we going to do with this? And we started with Rav Shimon Schwab. And Rav Shimon Schwab wrote an article, which we're going to see today, one of his solutions. In 1962, he wrote there, and I remind you what we talked about last week, how is any intelligent yeshiva student or Beit Yaakov girl going to rest at night, sleep at night when she's rolling around in bed thinking about the discrepancy between the years as set out by Seder Olam Rabba and the classic system. So he said, we have to answer this question. And Rav Shimon Schwab suggested there are only apparently two ways to answer this. Either they're right and we're wrong, or they're wrong and we're right. And we looked at those two approaches. We looked at the possibility that maybe we should just ignore secular dating. It's clearly wrong. Maybe it's been manipulated. We looked at two possibilities as to why it may have been manipulated. Either like Rav Sajigon. Rav Sajigon's living 1,100 years ago dealing with this question. This is not a new question. Rav Sajigon, if you remember, suggested that the Christians inserted the years into the calendar to push the date of Jesus forward towards the end of the Second Temple period for their own reasons. We talked about the 490 years, prophesied in Daniel, etc. And then we looked at Rabbi Alexander Hull's suggestion, which was that the Greeks manipulated the system and put the extra years in to make out that Alexander the Great actually defeated once and for all Persia, whereas in fact it wasn't really true. Alexander the Great defeated one of the kings of Persia, but Persia limped on for another 100 and something years, and the Greeks wanted to try and brush over that. So that was the kind of they're wrong, we're right approach. And then we looked at, maybe Seder Olam Rabbah is more of a midrashic work. Maybe Seder Olam Rabbah is not to be read in a literal way. We looked at different sources. We saw already many classic sources. Rashi mentions a Persian king that is not in Seder Olam Rabbah and says, okay, there are other kings. It's Lav Dafka, these three. The Ibn Ezra, the Abarbanel, the Rav Zachariah Levi. We saw with the Balaam Or. We talked about all of these people last week who say that there are other kings. Seder Olam Rabbah is Lav Dafka. It's not necessarily only three. You don't have to take it literally. It's not pshat, etc. That is a legitimate approach which you could go down, and then the problem sort of goes away a little bit. However, today I want to look at what I think is the most interesting way of answering the problem, which is the they're right and we're right answer. Okay, how can they be right and we be right? Good question. You're also right. So how can everybody be right? So I'd like to start off with Rav Shimon Schwab. He gives his own answer. Of course, he set up the problem. When he said, surely they must be wrong and we must be right, or they must be right and we must be wrong, he's only setting you up for his real revelation, which is in 1962, he comes up with the following suggestion. And we'll see soon, one of the most interesting things about Rav Shimon Schwab is he suggested in 1962, and then in 1991, he rolls it right back and says, maybe I should never have said this. And we'll have to work out what happened between 1962 and 1991 to have caused that retraction. Let's have a look. Let's start at the bottom of the page one, and we'll see a passage from Daniel. Right at the end of Daniel. Now, Daniel is a very difficult sefer. There are all sorts of references to dates and the end. It talks a lot about the case. Something's happening at the case, the end. Now, what does it mean, the end? The end of days. Apocalyptic is part of a whole genre of literature from the Second Temple period, which is highly apocalyptic. So have a look at what he says at the end. Number one. Ve'ata Daniel Satom Hadvarim. You, Daniel, this is what I want you to do, says Hashem to Daniel. Seal it all up. Seal all these things up. Ve'chatom Hasefer. And seal up the book. Add eight cases. Until the time which is the end. You shout it to Rabbim, and then everybody's going to run around. Fatir behadat, and knowledge will increase. Now, what does that mean? Apparently, Daniel is being asked to hush it all up and seal it up, and eventually, at the end of days, something is going to be revealed, and everyone will know what everyone's talking about. So turn over the page, and let me read to you. I'm not going to read the entire selection here, but what I've given you is on page 2 and page 3, I'm sorry the printing is a little bit small, but it should be legible. On page 2 and page 3 are Rav Shimon Schwab's, or part of his original article. So if you could start, please, in B, on the top box, where it says B, and there's a little number 1. Everyone with me? On the left-hand side, in the top box, B1. So I'm not going to read every word here, but let's have a look. There seems to be left, as yet unexplored, only one avenue of approach to the vexing problem confronting us. It should have been possible that our sages, for some unknown reason, had, quote, covered up, unquote, a certain historic period, and purposely eliminated and suppressed all records and other material pertaining thereto. He calls this later a holy conspiracy. Now, when I mention this to people, people start to get a little bit uncomfortable and hot under the collar. Say, I don't like the idea of any kind of conspiracy, whether it's holy or unholy. But Rav Shimon Schwab will say, don't worry, because this was a commanded conspiracy. We'll see where it comes from. And Chazal took these dates out. Nothing short of a divine command could have prompted Chazal, the saintly men of truth, to leave out completely from our annals a period of 165 years and to correct all data in historical tables in such a fashion, etc., etc. Go to number 2. In the course of our inquiry, we do indeed find a divine command. Seal the words, close the book, what we just read, etc. In writing his divinely inspired book, which is, by the way, interesting, divinely inspired, Daniel is a Navi, but his book is in Ksuvim, not in Nevi'im. And that itself is an interesting question as to how can you be a Navi and have your book in Ksuvim? And that raises the broader question is, well, what exactly is the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim? The classic answer that he's alluding to is the Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim, and this is picked up by the Radak and others, that Nevi'im was written by Nevuah,
with Nevuah, and Ksuvim was written with Ruach HaKodesh, whatever the difference is between them. But it's difficult because sometimes the same posuk appears in twice. Mikimi mi'afaldal, yeah? That appears in Shirat Chana, okay? And it also appears in Tehillim. One of them is in Nevi'im, one of them is in Ksuvim. Are they the same thing? Are they not the same thing? If you're interested, I have a whole share on that, but that's not for now. But he says basically this was written by Ruach HaKodesh, which explains the dark and obscure language of Sefer Daniel. It also gives us a perfect right to assume that certain historical events revealed to Daniel were omitted by him on purpose in faithful obedience to a divine command. And then he gives in number 3 a little proof. He talks about the Sefer Yuchsin. The Sefer Yuchsin, which it refers to in Chazal, which was hidden. And he says, aha, you see that there is a book from around this period which Chazal say has to be put away and hidden. Maybe this is the book that contains all the information of the 165 years. All of this is speculative, you have to understand, but it's interesting nonetheless. Let's go down to the bottom box. It says number 3 here, on the left-hand side. We are now faced with 2 questions. Suppose a holy conspiracy had existed all along, what would have been its reason? And B, why should we today be allowed to rend apart the veil of obscurity which was drawn in ancient days, hiding the chronological truth from our people? Meaning, he has to justify how he's let the cat out of the bag in 1962 when it's been happily obscure for the last 2,500 years. So basically he says here in the next paragraph, we propose the following explanation. In Sanhedrin we find a stern condemnation of all those who conjecture the messianic date from the last chapter of Daniel. You shouldn't be trying to work out when Mashiach is coming. The Rambam is very critical of those who try and calculate a date for when Mashiach is going to come, Tipach Rucham, etc. And then in the Igeres Teiman, of course, the Rambam himself does exactly that. He calculates the date when Mashiach is going to come, and of course that date came and that date went, and Mashiach has not yet come. And he says here, had it not been for the fact that the important parts of those prophecies have been left out or were personally obscured, the clues for the messianic date found in Daniel might have yielded the desired results. This was rendered impossible by hiding certain data and certain chronological material. Although we do not presume that anyone living today would be capable to calculate anything concerning Viyat HaMashiach, we still would not assume the right to unveil a mystery which should so be carefully hidden by our forebears, unless the mystery had been unveiled all by itself. He's saying we've done a very good job of keeping this under wraps, but now, he says, I'm going to tell you the truth because the truth has come out without me. Not by arguing, but by the archaeological discoveries made during the last century and a half. The earth has indeed opened its mouth and yielded countless bits of material in the form of decoded and readable clay tablets, inscriptions on rocks, and the temple ruins, etc., pertaining to the Persian era. This is a fascinating way of tying together the academic evidence and the hashgafic approach. Basically, he's saying that I'm not troubled by all the archaeological evidence. I'm excited by it because that is the process of hashgacha itself causing these realities of history to come out into the public forum. And now that humanity has, if you like, uncovered that, now you can see it's the time for us to uncover the whole thing and tell people that Mashiach is obviously nearly here. And therefore he says the historical information itself has given him the right to talk about this. Now, go over to the right-hand side in number 4. In spirit of the aforesaid, a new light is shed on the strange fact that, and he raises a point we'll come back to soon, soon after Ezra and Nehemiah, a new method of counting the years was introduced by our sages, a method which was retained for well over 1,200 years by our people. We're referring to the so-called Greek era, Minyan Shtarot. In Seder Olam 30, we are told that in exile we are to write into our documents the date according to Minyan Shtarot Alpha. We'll get back to Alpha in a minute. The term Minyan Shtarot means the era of contracts and refers to the so-called Seleucid era. And he talks about how this works and how basically all Jewish documentation from this point onwards was not dated from creation, was not dated on the basis of a Jewish chronology, but was dated by Minyan Shtarot. And you can go into the Cairo Geniza, you can pull things out from the early medieval period, and you'll find that they are dated according to Minyan Shtarot. Why would we suddenly stop dating things in a Jewish way and start dating things based on Alexander the Great? Obvious. Because we wanted to try and start afresh to hide the fact that 165 years have been taken out of the calendar. Therefore, it's perfect. That's exactly why we started doing this. He says this at the bottom here. Why did Chazal, the bottom of that page, why did Chazal adopt the generally accepted non-Jewish calendar for all our documents instead of a Jewish system? There seems to be only one satisfactory answer, although we'll see soon Rabbi Menachem Liebtag gives another one, okay? Because it was part of a scheme to, quote, close up the words and seal the book over the page. A certain period of time had to be hidden. This was accomplished effectively indeed by the switch to the Greek date. And I'm going to leave you to read the most of the top paragraph yourself. He basically suggests the following. He says, this is what I think happened. They came back to start building the second temple, and it was a bit of a Nebuch situation. And in fact, Chazal say that. They say when they first built the second temple, the young people were dancing, and the old people were crying, because the new people were saying, look at this beautiful temple, and the old people were saying, this is only beautiful because you don't remember what we used to have. This is Nebuch compared to what we used to have. So says Rav Shimon Schwab, the temple building period took two phases. At the beginning, they built a small temple, what they could do with the opposition that they had from the people at the time, the Samaritans, and then Cyrus rolled back his permission, etc. Then eventually, 150-60 years later, that's when Ezra came, that's when Nehemiah came, and that's when they were able to build the proper temple, the real second temple. Okay, it wasn't as great as the final Herodian version of the temple, but it was a lot better than what they had before, and therefore the second temple was built, if you take it, two shlavim. Shlav Aleph was this miskain side of the second temple at the beginning, and then 160 years later, Shlav Bet was the real temple, if you like, and that's where we count the 420 years. Therefore, he says, when Chazal say the second temple lasted for 420 years, he means the second temple that we're really going to call a temple. Because the first one was just a slow process of getting things moving, and basically that these two paragraphs, he sets that out, and he says that's his thesis, and therefore we are now able to understand everything works together. The secular dating is correct. Chazal is correct. We know why they did what they did. And now it's near to Mashiach. And Baruch Hashem, it's now the year 5947. And everybody's happy. And they're invested for around 50 years. Less, about 30 years. And Rabbi Shimon Schwab, and I mentioned to you once that I was giving a shir about this. And I mentioned this. I wasn't giving a shir specifically on this. A lady came up to me afterwards and said to me, it's interesting you mentioned Rabbi Shimon Schwab because I knew him very well. I said, that's very interesting, I never met him, how did you know him? She said, he's my father. And I said, ah. Yes, Miss Grossman. And I said, did I say anything wrong? And she said, no. She said, he used to talk about this at the Shabbos table. This was something that interested him greatly. And those who are interested in more of his writings can find this. As I said, this original article was written up in a festschrift for Rav Breuer, for Dr. Breuer, in 1962. Now, fast forward to 1991 and go for you onto page 4. Rabbi Shimon Schwab has two books of selected speeches which were put together and later published. And this is from one that he gave, an article that he wrote in 1991. So if you look on the top here, we'll read most of this together. So he says, I printed about 30 years ago in Ateret Tzvi, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Breuer's Jubilee volume, etc., and I was revised a few times. The purpose of this attempt was to assist the bewildered Torah true students of Jewish history sitting on the horns of a dilemma, and to strengthen their emunah. I did it to strengthen emunah. Time and again I was urged to publish this revised edition in order to serve a larger readership, but in the meantime, many great doubts have bothered my mind and have made it mandatory for me to share my pangs of conscience with my readers. And now you'll see a very interesting pulling back by Rabbi Shimon Schwab of his position. Let's see whether he really means it or whether he doesn't mean it. Okay, let's see. A. History is either true or false. Well, that's actually itself a very interesting statement, which is not so clear. And we'll come back to that at the very end, okay, where we're going to bring Rabbi Shaul Lieberman in on this particular issue. History is either true or false. There is no middle ground. The events described in a history book have either happened or they haven't. The most ingenious theories, which may have their place in philosophy or as a working thesis in the exact sciences, have no meaning in the pursuit of historical evidence, which is a search for facts, which accepts no conjectures. Again, I'm not sure that he really could have meant this, because history is highly conjectural, okay? A chronological timetable is the backbone of any book on history which expects to be accepted by intellectually honest students. Now, B. If our forefathers wanted to hide a certain period in our history because of a divine mandate, who has the right to uncover the carefully concealed secret? Even with our best intentions to strengthen the faith of those who doubt the accuracy of our traditional method of counting the years, we still were not given the right to remove the veil for any reason. Now, before he said we were given the right because archaeology had revealed it, he's not so sure now. Therefore, I feel like the legendary king of the Khazars, who was told a few times in a dream, okay, Kavanascha Ritsuya, Aval Ma'asecha Einu Ritsuyim, your intentions are good, but your actions are not. The hidden years theory necessitates the assumption, this is C, that the construction of the Second Temple lasted for a century and a half, which, by the way, would explain the discrepancy between the measurements of Vaisheni and Ezra and those of Maseches Midas. It would also explain why the Anshei Knesset Gedolah is speaking the Mishnah of Lifnim Min HaKilayim. He then has a whole paragraph explaining how his previous theory is actually brilliant, because it explains so many other things that don't necessarily make sense. When they built the Second Temple, he talks about inside the curtains, even though there were no curtains in the Second Temple. He says, aha, there were no curtains in the second version of the Second Temple, but there were maybe still curtains in the first version of the Second Temple. And therefore, he spends a whole paragraph saying how actually it would work. True, he says then at the end, there's a reference to this in the book of Ben Sira, with another interesting reference. The book of Ben Sira is a book in the Apocrypha, actually it's a pseudepigrapha probably, which is, Ben Sira is like a Mishle, it's a type of wisdom literature which never made it into Tanakh, although Chazal do quote from the book of Ben Sira in a number of different places. A shir on the Apocrypha is a whole other story which we might have at one stage, although I'm not sure it's a contemporary halakhic issue, but I'm not sure this is either, but okay, fine, we'll worry about that now. Then he talks about Josephus and says he wasn't so frum. And then he says, one letter writer suggested to me the most ancient documents are so unclear, confusing, self-contradictory. We don't have to take the conclusion of modern historians seriously. Now, again, this is very different from what he said in 1962. Right. In 1962, he said it's completely incompetent to say that academic findings are all wrong. How could you possibly say that? He says they're irrefutable. There's so much evidence. There's so much investigation. And now he's saying that, I don't know, maybe academic investigation, you could turn around and say it's wrong. Although he says someone said that. He's not saying it, but someone told him that. Then he talks about Rav Sadigon, which we talked about. Then he talks about the Moilad, which is if we start unpicking Seder Olam Rabbah, it may have consequences for the Moilad, which is a halakhic calculation of the moon, so it's not so straightforward. And then he says in G, go to the bottom paragraph, and this is where I think we have to look carefully to the end. We are now counting the year 5751. This was written in 1991. The year I got married, actually. And if we add 168 years, the real date for the year would be 5919, which leaves only 81 years till the end of the sixth millennium. Now that date has gone down from 81 to more like 45 or something like that, 50. This is most frightening, especially for all those born not so long ago or those to be born in the near future who would become the living witnesses of the end of days. They will see with their own eyes whether the statement that the world will exist only for 6,000 years and then be destroyed is meant to be taken literally or has a different interpretation as do many Agadic pronouncements. Which is actually itself, just stop and think about that. He said, the year 6,000 is nearly coming. But of course that may not be literal anyway, and Mashiach may not come by the year 6,000. Maybe that's an Agadah to be understood in a Midrashic way. But the people who are alive today will work that out. There's a story, it's apocryphal, I don't know if it's true, they asked the Chofetz Chaim, what would you do if the year 6,000 came in and Mashiach had not yet come? He said, I daven Ma'ariv. You know, meaning, you know, it's lav dafke that Mashiach has to come by the year 6,000. What interesting proof that may not be the case could be from Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva felt that Bar Kochba was the Mashiach, as did many other rabbis in his generation. Now, Bar Kochba was before the year 4000. Okay? So if you hold by that Midrash that Mashiach can come between 4000 and 6000, then you could say that Rabbi Akiva obviously did not hold by that because he felt the Mashiach was coming even before the year 4000. Unless, of course, you counter that Rabbi Akiva knew full well that it wasn't really the year 4000, was it? It was 165 years later. In which case, you could say that Rabbi Akiva was right on the button, and Mashiach could come because it was later than people thought. Anyway, Rabbi Schwab is not happy that people are going to be close to the year 6000. I'm writing all this with awe and trepidation. On the other hand, if the hidden years never were, then mankind still has 250 years before the coming of the end. It is because of all these gnawing doubts that I have decided to put a big question mark after the words Jewish chronology. Let someone with greater knowledge come and pick up the threads where I left off. Our traditional, universal, accepted Jewish way of counting the years is sacred territory, which only fools do not fear to tread upon. At least in 1991, that's true. This may be a disappointment to some, but on the other hand, I muster the courage to belong to those who rather wish to be honest with themselves than to be right. I would rather leave a good question open than risk giving a wrong answer. And I followed the teachings of Rabbi Shimon, who said, "Kashem shekivalti schar al hadrisha, kein akabel schar al aprisha." Just as I rewarded for the research, may I be awarded for the retraction. The historical material which I have assembled may still be somehow useful, even for those who will doubt whether there can ever be a Jewish chronology which would satisfy the non-believer in the wisdom of our sages. So I fall back in the ranks of all Shleimei Emunei Yisrael, and to me, Lebriyat HaOlam means what it meant to our fathers. It is as simple as that. And while we may keep on searching for the answers, we pray Hashem will enlighten our eyes. Okay, now, did he retract or did he not retract? He's not sure. What happened in the meantime? Now, I'm not able to speak to Rav Shimon Schwab and ask him this question. Some of you may in this room have asked him this question. But clearly a lot changed in the world between 1962 and what was on the menu of acceptable Orthodox discussion. And 1991, the whole, you know, art scroll world had begun in the 1970s and 1980s. And Rav Shimon Schwab was, it seems to me, clearly under pressure of some kind to publish this kind of a retraction, which he hedges a little bit, but he's not entirely happy with it. I feel a little bit like, the Ramban, which quotes the Morin Avuchim, which we had a Shabbos here with the Shabbos on Choir, and I mentioned it on Shabbos. So the Rambam there, the Morin Avuchim, Maimonides, says that the three Malachim that came to Avram Avinu were in Avram Avinu's dream. They were not Malachim in real time. The whole thing was in a Nevuah, and Sarah laughed in a Nevuah, and the whole vision of Lot, etc., etc. And the Ramban, which quotes the Morin Avuchim, says there, Chas Shalom, you can't believe such things, you're not allowed to learn such things, you're not allowed to teach such things, which I mentioned was ironic, because how many people learn the Morin Avuchim? Not as many as learn the Ramban Al HaTorah, and if not for the Ramban Al HaTorah, you wouldn't have known that the Morin Avuchim said that. But okay, that's the irony of life. So I asked my Rebbe once, so am I allowed to teach the Rambam, you know, in Morin Avuchim, when the Ramban says, it's also to teach this? So he said to me, well, of course, as long as you teach the Morin Avuchim and then teach the Ramban, who says it's also to teach the Morin Avuchim. As long as you teach both, then that's legitimate. So I feel a little bit the same here. As long as I can teach the 1962 version, as long as I teach the 1991 version that says not to teach the 1962 version, or not exactly, but that could be. So I leave you to think about Rav Shimon Schwab and work out where you want to plug that in, but he was the one that really brought this onto the stage. Since him, there have been a number of other attempts to deal with this problem, and I'd like to present to you three more. Two of them were innovated, I think, by Rav Menachem Liebtag, and I'm going to bring you what he said. One of them is in a very interesting article, which you will find in Hakira Journal, on the 2,000 years of Torah. Have a little look, please, on the top of page 4. Five, excuse me. Thank you very much. Page 5. I was the lawyer, not the accountant, so numbers for me were never quite the same. Mm-hmm. So if you look here in Sanhedrin, in source number 4, Tana Beit Be'er Eliyahu. So Tana Beit Eliyahu says as follows, Sheishis Alafim Shana Haya Olma. So this is the source that we were talking about before. 6,000 years will the world exist. Shnei Alafim, okay, Tohu. There were 2,000 years of void. Shnei Alafim Torah, 2,000 years of Torah, and Shnei Alafim Yemos Mashiach, and 2,000 years which have the potential for Mashiach. Now, where you calculate the end of the 2,000 years of Torah is very important, and it can be halakhically important. In parentheses, I'll mention why. The Chazon Ish raises a question elsewhere on the Simani Trefus. And he asked an interesting question. According to halacha, certain animals are considered trefas if they have certain sicknesses or holes in certain organs, which Chazal say they will not be able to live for 12 months if they have such a condition. Therefore, these animals are trefas, as opposed to nevela, which has not been shechted properly. These animals are trefas, and they may not be eaten. When you open them up and you check their organs, you find that they were trefas. So the question, of course, comes today. We have animals walking around for years and years quite happily with these particular sicknesses because we pump them with antibiotics and we treat them in certain ways. In fact, ironically, we create these trephers by injecting the antibiotics into them and puncturing the organs and making them into trephers. Now, but they continue to live. This, by the way, is why Rav Herschel Schachter raises the question whether you can drink any milk at all today from a regular herd of cows. Because the only reason you can drink milk, say Chazal, is because we assume that roiv cows are not trefas. Meaning, you don't know when you milk the cow if the animal's a trefa. You can, when you shecht it, you can open it up and check it. And then you'll know if you can eat it or can't eat it. But when you milk the cow, unless you have x-ray vision, you can't see inside the cow. But Chazal says, since most cows are not trefas, then you can assume this was also fine. Says Rav Schachter, I'm not sure anymore that most cows are not trefas, because many cows are now injected in certain ways that they are trefas, and therefore maybe you can't drink the milk. Leave that for another discussion. And he's not talking about Chalav Yisrael, he's talking about any milk, unless you go to an organic farm or something like that. So the Chazon Ish says, so why do we still stick to the classic Simani trefas, even though there are animals today that do survive when Chazal said they can't survive? And the answer is, because all the Torah that we needed was downloaded during the 2,000 years of Torah. The 2,000 years of Torah run roughly from when Avram Avinu discovered God, okay, when he was however old, you were going to say 52 or whatever, until ... and we'll see right now. And therefore, anything that comes after the 2,000 years of Torah is after we went offline, if you like. Anything that's being downloaded after that is not getting through to the halakhic system, because the 2,000 years of Torah are finished, and the gates are closed, and so that's all that we have. And therefore, dating these 2,000 years of Torah becomes actually very relevant. Have a look at the Yaivas here. Basically, the thesis of this article is that Chazal wanted very much to end the 2,000 years of Torah at the end of the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah is the cut-off line beyond which we really don't learn any new principles in Torah Shebaal Peh. And we see this in a number of different references. Look at number 5. The Achakach Paska Torah Me'eretz Yisrael. This is the after the end of the Mishnah, says the Yaivetz. Torah really left Eretz Yisrael. Ki achaz manzeh, after this period, lo matzino oid yeshivat gedoilat sham. We don't find any more major yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael from, we're talking about around the year 180 CE, up until the 20th century, there were no major yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael of this nature. The Nishlam Dora Tanaim, this was the end of the Tanaim, Shehai Yishonim Kamoshe Mipi Agvura, they used to teach Torah just like Moshe taught it. The Nitchadish Dora Amoraim, from then on there was a new generation of Amoraim, the rabbis of the Gemara. Shinati Torah Kishtei Torah, and now Torah became fragmented, bifurcated. Vagamin az vahala, azlat yad vagamin vatoikev hagolas. Then the golas really set in very, very harshly. Bagoyim ein Torah. Pasuk from Eicha. Bagoyim ein Torah. Once we're with the Goyim, there is no Torah anymore. That means in Babel. In Eretz Yisrael, there was still Torah. But once the Mishnah was finished, that was the end of Torah. So too the Marashah says in number 6, V'nira lefarish ha-dvarim kapashtan. Once we left into the real Golas, there is no more Torah really. For another 172 years after the Baisheni, Mikra Adain Mir Shnas Torah. That can still be called the end of the days of Torah. Ki az hayudor hatanaim, this was the generation of Tanaim, but adain lo nidaldalu yeshivas ad acha shemet Rebbe. The yeshivas didn't finally dwindle until after Rebbe died, v'gava agalas, and the galas got so strongly, v'rabu hasoros v'kalu yimei hatorah. U'misham v'eilech, from that point onwards, mitoich agalas, in our galas, v'hasoros v'chol oisiz man, ra'ui levah Mashiach, that's where Mashiach can come. V'yimei Chevlei Mashiach Mikri. And that's called the days of Chevlei Mashiach. So this is not just a random cut-off date. This is very important to us. The Torah on a certain level came to an end in terms of Torah Shebaal Peh, and then a new period started when the Tanaim finished and the Amoraim started. So too, to the authors of this article, suggesting number 7. We suggest that the Chachamim were concerned about the acceptance of the Mishnah. Now this is even more conjecture, I think, than Rav Schwab, because Rav Schwab was a Gadol Hador, and these, Talmidei Chachamim, but they're suggesting an answer. To ensure its unequivocal adoption, they wanted the completion of the Mishnah to occur approximately 2,000 years after the start of the Torah period. In this way, they were promulgating that the 2,000-year interval sandwiched between Avraham at the age of 52 and the completion of the Mishnah represented the era of Torah, and that the Mishnah punctuated the end to this creative Torah period. It also meant that the Amoraim who were to follow would not be included in the creative period of the Torah. If this meant chronologically short-changing the time of the Second Temple, so be it. The author of the chronology was Rabbi Yosef Achalafta, Rabbi's teacher. The idea for the Mishnah didn't start with Rabbi, but rather came to complete fruition with him. And this is a very interesting idea, that there was another agenda. Like Rav Shimon Schwab, he said there was an agenda. It was consciously done, but it was done to really emphasize that the Mishnah was the end of Torah Shebaal Peh in that way. And as I said, this is an important point. Halachically as well, the Amoraim didn't really darshan from the Torah the same way that the Tanaim did. The Tanaim used the text of the Torah and create drash. They create new halacha. The Amoraim do not really do that very much. They do that a little, but very little, but not very much at all. They take what the Mishnah has given them and they analyze it and distill it and paskin from it, if you like. But the Tanaim and the Amoraim are really doing two very different things. I'll throw something else into the mix. The Amoraim are the ones that come up with the idea that they, in their generation, they don't feel confident they have a completely accurate version of the Sefer Torah itself. Whereas into the times of the Tanaim, they felt that they did. And that's an interesting side issue that they say. It's very few differences, maybe chaser v'male, above here and above there, but those differences can make a difference. And once that happens, then you can't darshan in the same way. As you probably know, our Ashkenazi and Sephardi Sefer Torah are identical because they were, if you like, harmonized in the Middle Ages. But the Yemenite Sefer Torah is still very slightly different. It has a few differences. The only one of those is a difference that seems to make a significant difference, which is in Parshas Noach, where our Sefer Torah says Vayehi Yemei Noach, and the Yemenite Sefer Torah says Vayehiyu Yemei Noach. Okay? So I ended up on a Yemenite yeshuv 2 years ago, and I got the aliyah that had this in it. So the guy looked at me, and I don't know, do I look Tamari? Not really. Maybe, yes, a little bit. Okay, well, whatever. So he looked at me, and he said, Ata Ashkenazi, again? Or Sephardi, Ata Sephardi, because people think I'm Sephardi. Okay? I said, no, I'm the Ashkenazi, Bemet. Okay, Bemet. So he said, oh, I don't know what we're going to do because, you know, this is a Tamani Sefer Torah and your gears is different, etc., etc. So in the end, he read it as it was written, and then he read it again, Baal Peh, the way I would say it, because it's very interesting. Anyway, I was with one of my friends there, and I said to him, I said, you know, this is just my thing. I said, people would give money to get this aliyah, yeah? So he said to me, no, actually people would give money not to get it. Okay? So I said, therein lies the difference between you and me, okay? But, so if you ever happen to be called up in Parshas Noach, I think it's in Shishi, then you'll know what's going on. So fine, the 2,000 years of Torah maybe comes to an end, and that's where the dates come from. Now, let me give you two other suggestions that Rabbi Liebtag came up with that got him into some hot water as well. He said these in Tinek, and some of the Rabbonim in Tinek were not happy with it, and we can, I'm Avin Yovin, you can look at that up in your own way. So have a look here in number 8. Rabbi Liebtag, in his first suggestion, says, you know something? You know what adding these extra years, or rather taking these years out of the calendar does? I'll tell you what it does. It harmonizes Minyan Shtaros with Yetzias Mitzrayim. Meaning, Rav Schwab already raised the question. Why do we suddenly start using a non-Jewish dating system? That doesn't sound like the kind of thing we do. Okay? Especially Dafka in the time of the Greeks, when we're kind of fighting against it a little bit. So his answer was, well, it was there to hide the like holy conspiracy. Rabbi Liebtag says, no, it was there to make the Minyan Shtaros exactly 1,000 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. so that when you use the non-Jewish date, when you use the Goyish date, if you just add 1,000 years onto the front of that date, oh, it now becomes a Jewish date, because you're dating from Yetzias Mitzrayim. Have a look at number 8. Rabbi Yossi Omer Malchus Paras Bifnei Habayis Lamadalet Shana. There are 34 years of Persia before the temple was built. Malchus Yavan Meir Shmonim, we looked at this last time. 180 years of Greek rule with the temple. Malchus Beit Chashmonai Meir Shalosh. Sorry, these are years where the temple was built, I should say. 103 years. Malchus Hurdus Meir Shalosh. 103 years of Herod. Mikan Ba'elech Sevi Chashim Lechurban Abayis. Fine. Ubegola, says Sefer Olam Rabba, says Sefer Olam Rabba, in the Galut, Kotvin Beshtarot, we write all our documents, Leminyan Yavanim Alpha. Mother Alpha. You should say Minyan Yavanim. Why Minyan Yavanim Alpha? So Rabbi Schwab, in a bit that I didn't read out to you, says, well, they had three different versions of how to count the Greeks. This was Minyan Alpha, Minyan Beta, and Minyan Gamma. Says Rabbi Litag, I don't think so. Look at number 9, please. In the last 2 weeks, now, I will just caveat, this is not Rabbi Litag's actual words. This was written up by one of his Talmidim, and it's on the website, so I can't promise that he would actually say exactly this, but you can call him up. That's the advantage with this source. You can just call him up and ask him. Okay, I can give you his number. It's on my phone. Maybe I should have done that, but okay. In the last 2 weeks, we presented Seder Olam Rabba and its chronology. We showed how its approach to text and history reveals a consistent methodology if it doesn't match conventional dating. With all that we mentioned above, there must still be a reason why Seder Olam skipped so much. Whilst it is a minimalist work, there still should be justification for this course of action. Several suggestions are given, and we will present two that seem to be the most compelling. The first answer has to do with Minyan Shtaros, also known as the Seleucid era or Anu Greekorum, the Greek year. This is the dating system that Jews accepted in the latter half of the Second Temple period. This camp began in what we today refer to as 312 BCE. During this year was fought the Battle of Gaza, leading to Seleucus' successful conquering of Babylon. The Greeks decided that this year would be year one. Along with the Seleucid Empire and other Hellenistic civilizations, the Jews adopted a system. Throughout the Talmud, there is evidence of documents being dated with respect to this year. And now, at first glance, the year 312 BCE is not especially significant for Jewish history. But the Vilna Gaon points out that as per Seder Olam Rabba, 313 BCE, the effective year zero, of course there was never a year zero in any of these counts, is found to be exactly 1,000 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because the Seder Olam, the Seleucid year, was effectively sanctified, a document dated with this count to the 45th year, for example, suddenly becomes synonymous with 1,045 years since Yetzias Mitzrayim. Support for this can be found in the line at the end of Seder Olam of a Goyle Kosim is Shtaris the Minyan Yavanim Alpha, and in exile they write on the Shtaris of the Greek camp Alpha, Alpha meaning 1,000. Aleph. Aleph, Alpha is Aleph. Meaning the Seder Olam Rabba is telling you just add 1,000 on to the non-Jewish date, and it becomes a Jewish date. It's the date since Yetzias Mitzrayim. Very interesting. Okay? So he says that's why the dates were harmonized. The last reason that we're going to give here is what you might call a more Zionistic reason. I think this is the one that probably got him into trouble. But let's have a look. Another apparent justification for Seder Olam skipping over 165 years is the assumption that years without Jewish progress, particularly in the context of the Second Beit HaMikdash, are effectively removed from Jewish history, as they are not worthy to have existed. This notion can explain the three sets of years which we said to have skipped over by Seder Olam. Now, moving slightly forward in history, modern history reveals that the Purim story, and here's in Purim Katan today, Shushan Purim Katan, so let's have a bit of Purim, hopefully not Purim Torah, but Purim-related Torah. The Purim story probably took place after the second Beit HaMikdash was already built. Interesting, huh? Rather than leaving the exile, even after the Beit HaMikdash construction, Jews were living and thriving in Shushan HaBira. The Pasuk Ish Yehudi Haya v'Shushan HaBira u'Shmo Mordechai, okay, should be read with shock rather than with pride. Mordechai is a leader in Persian politics when his nation has the ability to return to Israel. Even his name is derived from the Persian deity Marduk. Okay? Jewish leader with a non-Jewish name in a non-Jewish place with doing a non-Jewish job when he could just be on a nefesh for nefesh flight and with his family, and he'll be living in Eretz Israel. No wonder so much sorrow happens. Okay? By moving Achashverosh from after Daryavish to before Daryavish, and the previous installment deals with that,
The years of Jewish history when the Jews failed to return to Israel were effectively erased from the count. Even well after the Mikdash was built, though, Jewish history failed to significantly progress towards the divine goal. The Mikdash is completed in the year 6 of Dariavish, we saw that last week, after which Jewish life was weak and leaderless for several decades until Ezra's ascent in the year 7 of Artashasta. For thematic reasons, the book of Ezra closes the gap on these years in which there's no progress, and Seder Olam takes the next step and makes it that these years never existed. And therefore, Chazal was so embarrassed by the fact that the Jews did not take up the call and return to Eretz Yisrael, these years are just out. We don't even want to talk about them. It's just a national embarrassment. Yes?
I don't understand the line of choice
was after the Beit HaMikdash, not before.
The whole point Ahasuerus made that feast was because 70 years had passed and it hadn't...
Good, but the feast of Ahasuerus, up until the Ishayah the Shushan HaBirah, there's a very significant skip, okay? There's a skip already, you're right, you'd have to fit that Midrash with what Rabbi Litzhak is saying. So maybe that Midrash doesn't fit, maybe already in the time since the feast, it started to, don't forget the second beast built based on Midrash started to be built, and Ahasuerus stopped it. So it could be that's one of the things that's going on here. Whether you need to harmonize all the Midrashim is a good question. Whether this is true itself is a good question, okay? But for every medrash that you find like this, we'll find two others that say something slightly different, and that's one of the problems we had at the beginning. There are other hints as well, by the way. I just want to point out one that Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman mentioned, and then we'll look at the last section. Look at number 11. See, you spot the difference. Spot the problem, okay? This is from a classic piece of Mishnah that everybody knows, and you probably never realized this. This is in Pirkei Avos at the beginning. Antigonus Ishtoichoi Kibel Mishimon HaTzadik. Antigonus, already in the Greek period, he received the Masorah from Shimon HaTzadik. He has his statements. So Antigonus is the next one in the train. Yosi ben Yoeza, Ish Tzreda, for Yosi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim, Kiblu Mehem. Who did they get from? They got from Antigonus. Ishtoichoi. It should have been Kiblu Mimeno. Who's Kiblu Mehem? There are other people involved here that the Mishnah is skipping, that didn't want to tell you about, says Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman, or that could be other generations in the years that have in between, unless of course you're going to find me a Giras of the Mishnah that says Kiblu Mimeno, you could go and do some homework on that, but that is definitely something that is there, at least in our Giras, which may be a hint. Let me just give you some final thoughts and we'll leave this topic and we'll move on next week to gelatin, which is perhaps more down to earth, but no less complicated, I can promise you. Let's go back to the first point that Rabbi Schwab made. Is historical truth black and white? And there's a piece here which I brought you from the writings of Rav Shaul Lieberman, which makes a very interesting point. And he wants to talk here about the difference between historical truth and textual truth. Look at what he says in number 12. Okay? Alein lahavdil ben ha'emet hamuchletet. We have to distinguish between some kind of absolute truth, ha'historit, which is historical, meaning something did happen, one thing happened, ubein ha'emet shel ha'text, and between a textual truth. Ha'emet ha'historit, hi achat v'rak achat, which is what Rabbi Schwab said, historical truth is one and only one thing. Only one thing actually happened. Aval ha'emet shel ha'text, miyuchedet the text. But the truth of the text depends on the text, and depends on how you interpret the text. The kol text v'text ha'emet v'ha'emet shelo. Every text has its own emet. Based on where it came from. If, for example, he says there is a difference in Girsa between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, only one historical truth existed. When they wrote this Mishnah, they wrote it one way. They didn't write it two ways. Oka Bavli, Oka Yerushalmi. Either this way or that way, or perhaps neither way. But they didn't write it two ways. Aval ha'emet shel ha'text, hi b'mishnas ha'bavli k'masoret ha'bavli, mishnas Yerushalmi k'masoret Yerushalmi. But text takes on its own truth, which is very interesting. And he says, u'misha m'shana et ha'girsa, if now you want to be an academic, which of course Rabbi Lieberman was, and change the text in a Mishnah, l'fi ha'emet ha'historit, because you think you want to make it, harmonize it with a historical truth,
You can't do that. That blurs everything and is almost like a sin against the way the text works. What's going on here? It's a very interesting question. And Rav Hutna also talks about this. Historical truth is one thing and one thing only, but it's hidden. It's ganuz, says Rav Hutna. You don't know. None of us know what the historical truth is, and none of us ever will. Because even something that happened, forget about something that happened 3,000 years ago, even something that happened 3 weeks ago, there are different versions, there are different accounts. You could have two people standing there, and each one says, well, I don't think that's how it happened. We know this, we see this all the time. Forget about fake news and everything else. Historical reality is one and one only, but completely inaccessible. And anyone who thinks that they will get to the historical truth is just deluding themselves. So we may as well realize now that we'll never know exactly how the Second Temple dating system works. No one will ever know. It's ganuz. Says like Rav Hutna, like the Mishkan is ganuz. He has this whole piece where he talks about, there's a machloket about whether the boards of the Mishkan, the beams were square at the top or pointed at the top. Yeah? So he says, how can you have a machloket about that? Meaning, they didn't make two versions of the Mishkan. One which was square and one which was pointed. There's only one version of the Mishkan. The only problem is, it's gone. You don't know. We'll never know. And since we'll never know, we don't really care what the actual Mishkan looked like. What are we interested in? When we read a text about the Mishkan, what does this text mean? How do I read this text? What is God trying to communicate to me through this text? And that has a truth which I can access. Maybe more than one truth, because there's more than one way of understanding the text. But rather than getting bogged down in trying to chase after a historical truth that can never be achieved, because you'll never get there, find a textual truth which actually is more accessible because you can actually prove it from the text. This is a very interesting idea, and if you think about how fundamental this is, students sometimes ask me, I don't understand, how old was Yitzchak of the Akedah? According to Rashi, how old was Yitzchak of the Akedah? 37 years old, based on Seder Olam Rabbah. Okay? How do we know he's 37 years old? Well, you put together the text in a certain way. How old was Sarah when Yitzchak was born? 90. How old was Sarah when she died? 127. So how old was Yitzchak when Sarah died? 37. That's all based on just the numbers in the text. No speculation there. So, since we see that Sarah died at the Akedah, how do you know? Because look, it's the next thing, right? There's the Akedah, then there's the birth of Rivka, then there's the death of Sarah, the beginning of Chai Sarah. Since all those things are happening at the same time, so you know that Yitzchak was 37 years at the Akedah. What's the problem on a textual level with Yitzchak being 37 at the time of the Akedah? He doesn't sound like he's 37. He doesn't sound like he's 37. He's asking his father, like, you know, we've got this, we haven't got this, where's the sacrifice, what's going on? And also, if you go with that, it turns out the Rivka has to be how old?
Three.
And that doesn't sound like Rivka was three either. Because when she's getting the water and giving to the camels, meaning you have to stretch a little bit the credulity of the text. So Yitzchak to be 37 and Rivka to be 3. The Ibn Ezra comes out and says, I don't think that's the pshat. That's not the pshat. The pshat is that the Akedah happened years and years and years before Sarah died. Because you don't have to say it was exactly one after the other. The Chai Sarah already could be opening up a decade later. So Yitzchak may have been a small child. Now, he can't have been 3 or 4. Why not? Because he carries the wood. So he must have been 11, 12, 10, 11, 12. And therefore Rivka, now by the story of Rivka, she can be a teenager, she can be early 20s, and everything flows in a different kind of way. And by the way, that is a completely different reading of the Akedah. As opposed to Avram Avinu tying up a 37-year-old man who is saying, tie me up properly, I want to be a Korban to Hashem. He's now tying up an 11-year-old child who's screaming and kicking, saying, what's going on? It's a very different, it's a much more traumatic reading of the Akedah. But at the end of the day, so my students say, well, I don't understand. How can there be a machlokes about this? How can they disagree about whether he's 37 or whether he's 12? They can't both be right, nachon? How are you going to say, elu ve'elu dibur lekim chaim? And you can say on a halachic issue where he sees it this way, he sees it that way. But Yitzchak was an age at the Akedah. And the answer is, it's a historic, the age of Yitzchak at the Akedah is a historical reality which we can't access. But what we can access is the text How are you going to read the text where Hashem is telling us, this is how I want you to read the Akedah, this is how I want you to read the Parsha of Rivka? And that's the point, that we're not really arguing about the historical reality, we're arguing about what the text means. Yes, there was a historical reality, but that's not the point. The point is the text. That's why we're so focused on text. And by the way, there's a lot to say about this. That's why the Greeks and then the Christians were so unhappy about this. They're not so interested in text. They feel that the devil is in the detail, right? That's a Christian idea. We feel that, no, the truth, the emes is in the detail, and there's a lot more to say about that. So whether we should get too bogged down in historical realities is a good question. It's a bit warm in here, but it's a hot topic, so that's why you're hot. Let me leave the final word to Rabbi Wein. You had a question?
Is there any relevance to the Christian Catholic calendar, which has a different
calendar? Good question. I don't know enough about the Christian calendar. We talked a little bit 2 weeks about the Christian Coptic calendar in terms of the solar and lunar, but I don't know. Good research. I don't know much. I don't know anything about the Christian Coptic calendar, but I bet you'll find someone who does. So you get to check it out. I want to leave the last word to Rabbi Wein, because Rabbi Wein has a very good common sense perspective on Jewish history. He is one of the people who is responsible for bringing Jewish history into the mainframe over the last 30 years, 40 years. And he writes the following in his book on Jewish history, in Echoes of Glory. Let's finish with Rabbi Wein, and you can always go and check with him. He lives up the road. But he actually wrote this. Number 13. A peculiar problem arises regarding the dating of events in the early part of Jewish history. Baldly put, it is very difficult to reconcile the generally accepted systems of historical dating, and therefore the times of certain events within the system, with the traditional Jewish system of dating, those very events. So he says, I'm not going to hide this. This is a problem. I have nothing new to add to this debate regarding this problem. I accept the traditional Jewish system of dating the events of this period, and thus in this book, the First Temple destruction is dated not 516, but 423 BCE. It is the combination of my faith in the collective memory of the Jewish people and the convenience of following such a dating system that has led me to adopt this time sequence in this book. Okay? Leaving aside the fact that I think he would have got himself into trouble with people that would not have been happy if he'd used the other dating system, but, you know, he knows that too. There is actually a major philosophical undercurrent involved in this matter. In my opinion, he says, this conflict regarding the historical dating of the beginning of the Second Commonwealth is representative of a deeper issue of faith, which lies at the core of differing perspectives of Jewish history. History, unlike mathematics and other exact sciences, always contains a bit of error, bias, misinformation, disinformation, and selective reporting. Isn't that just what we were saying just now? Yet somehow there always emerges from this inexact subject called history a clear and informative pattern of civilizations rising and falling, shifting circumstances of life, of events, changing directions of value systems. The existence of some discrepancies or conflicting evidence, therefore, is a problem, quote unquote, but it doesn't refute the entire structure. So too is the traditional Jewish chronology. Nevertheless, almost with a perverse glee, secular Jewish historians and many non-Jewish historians, upon encountering problems such as the 166-year Second Commonwealth discrepancy, have rejected as inauthentic and inaccurate the entire traditional and Talmudic-oriented view of Jewish history. One's view of Jewish history, he says, depends on one's own personal agenda of life. Therefore, people of faith and belief who view the Jewish story in its miraculous totality will walk upon the paths of the Lord and will be able to live with apparent inconsistencies, inexact recollections, the possibility of a particular factual error, which nonetheless in no way challenged the overall story of God and Israel. But Jews fleeing from their heritage, frightened of their past, and unsure of their future, rejecting the notion of providence in the affairs of humans, will naturally fall and trip upon discovering any exactitude and discrepancy in traditional sources. The great Yiddish aphorism about life in general is, nobody dies because of a contradiction. If only this would be the attitude towards Jewish history as well. Which I think is a great way of looking at it. In the sense, yes, it's a problem. It's a minor problem. It doesn't undermine the themes of Jewish history that we see and know and learn and get inspired by. And therefore you get it, you see it, you move on, and you talk about gelatin next week. So between now and then, I wish you a very good week, and I hope to see you then. Very much.